See, the world is just a painful place. I'll tell you exactly how it's so. Under Promised Man was a terribly underrated show and never gave it the credit it deserved. I document this word and everything that I say right here. Understand it's perverse. See, Fred Dreyer wasn't a liar. Honest to God, followed the way of the gun and he solved crimes for everyone. But we all left that slide and let it disappear right for another crime scene investigative unit Miami, huh. Right?
That is the rapper Astronautilus, aka Andy Bothwell. And we have a great show for you today. We caught up with Andy on a lazy Saturday afternoon. He had just finished recording an album, so we got to talk to him about the process of recording. We got to talk to him about our shared love of music nerdery. We intended to talk to him for 15-20 minutes, and an hour and 15-20 minutes or so, we were just wrapping up. We're so proud of this guy. And we're so proud of this interview because, well, really, when you do an interview, it's only good as the guest you have. And, well, this guy's one of the best.
Mr. Bothwell.
Hey, Mrs. Looney, how you doing?
Hey, Andy.
Hey, Mrs. Looney, how you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Drinking some coffee, enjoying a Saturday.
Oh, that sounds good. See, it's noon here in Dallas, so we're already on to lunch.
Oh, it's noon here in Minnesota, too.
That's right. You're not
slow on the uptake today.
Yeah, you slept in today, didn't you, Andy?
I got slept all the way until 10. It was luxurious.
Wow.
Glorious.
That sounds good.
It was. It was fantastic.
Are you worn out after your recording?
No. I've kind of recovered from that now. Now I'm in sort of full swing on the business end of the thing, which is a different kind of being worn out, but it's still fun.
Well, I noticed that, and that's why I thought this would be a good time to call this man. To help him promote. But I do have a bone to pick with you, and that is your Jason Feathers record is so good, it's keeping me from listening to other things.
That's awesome.
Hey, that's just what you want to hear, isn't it, Andy?
That's the goal. My goal is to slowly remove any other piece of music as an option.
No, it's really fantastic, and I feel like I push it on all my friends because I'm like, you got to hear this.
That's great.
It's excellent.
I'm really excited for that record to have sort of a really slow-burning second life. That it didn't really get with the initial release. And what's been really great is, like, in this sort of second wave of growth that it's had, people are really getting into it, and the response is always the same, which I think is just fantastic. Is I don't really know what's going on this record at all, but I really like it.
But to me, I put it on, and I'm like, well, okay, so this is Jason Vernon, and here's Astronautilus making a record. And with about 2 seconds of, like, hearing it, I was like, oh, yeah, that's what that should sound like.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so I went from, like, I don't know how it's going to... Oh, yeah, that's it. They're okay.
There you go. We're good. We got it done. Moving on.
No, it's really good. And then I always crack up because Dara and I feel like every, like, lazy Sunday afternoon... Point Break always comes on TV, and you have that one track that is basically Point Break in song form.
Yep, pretty much. Yeah.
which makes you just love it even more.
What's funny is so a lot of that record was me freestyling. And essentially, like, some of the takes that are on the record are just me straight up an actual freestyle recorded, done one take, move on. And then that song in particular was, I basically, we made the beat and we just let the beat play, and I freestyled over it like for 5 minutes, took a minute break, started over, freestyled over for 5 minutes again, took a minute break, started over, freestyled for 5 minutes again, and then just took those three takes and just, you know, kind of, I worked out the storyline sort of in those freestyles and then took the lyrics, like the best lyrics from those three takes and pieced it together sort of like a collage.
Huh.
After it was all said, I was like, "Oh man, it's great! I really felt good about it." And then it was like, "We recorded," then I re-recorded the whole thing, and then someone was like, "That's basically Point Break, huh? Thinking I was so clever and cutting, and then realizing that I had just basically wrapped out Point Break.
Which is amazing.
No, it was all good. I stand by it. Like, I love that movie is so ingrained in my subconscious that it comes out in any bank robbery fantasy I have.
Oh, it's amazing. Well, the other reason that I thought it'd be good to talk to you at this point is I selfishly have this speaking engagement to a bunch of design students in March. Mm-hmm. And I thought,
in Dallas, so he gets to come home and visit.
That is true. Fantastic. I'm so excited. I bet you are.
But since you just came off this whole making a new record, I don't know. I thought talking about that creative process would tangentially kind of help, you know, anyone kind of in a creative industry. So it seemed like a good time.
I mean, it's an interesting thing. We're all getting older. And I had this realization the other day that I have been rapping for 20 years.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I started when I was 13. I am 33 now. And that just, like, blew my mind. It blew my mind. At this point in my life, I've had every job in the world. I've worked construction. I've been a teacher. I've washed dishes. I've waited tables. Like, I've had every job in the world. And the job that I have had the longest in my life is rapper now, which is the weirdest, best thing ever. and, like, man, oh, man, I get the biggest smile on my face when I tell that story. But it's interesting. This is my fifth full-length album, and you think that, like, after 20 years of, you know, essentially, you know, rapping, 11 years of doing it, you know, semi-professionally into professionally and full-time and making 5 records, you would think that it would get easier, but it doesn't.
No.
It doesn't at all. And, it, you know, some aspects of it get easier, but even now, like, so this record, the actual recording process of it was sort of the least stressful and most fun I've ever had recording a record. And so I thought, like, because normally recording a record is super stressful because I work really fast. I'm not the kind of guy that labors on a record for 2 years. I did that once on one record, and I'll never do it again because it was so mentally and emotionally exhausting. So I like to do it fast and sort of, you know, get the baby out, cut the umbilical cord, and slap it on the butt and go. And normally it's a pretty stressful thing, and this is a really fun process. And so I sort of foolishly thought, okay, cool, this is all just going to be easy. And then so we recorded it over the summer, and then I went to Dallas and mixed it in January.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, recording
didn't come by and see me, Andy.
I know.
Yeah, I forgive you. Oh,
thank you.
That's big of you, Mom.
I was in the studio.
He was working.
Couldn't take a break. I was working. Yeah. It's not like today.
Yeah, but I bet if you'd been hungry, you'd have been over here.
I was not taking very good care of myself. I was eating tacos and drinking Topo Chico all day long.
Yeah, okay. You're forgiven.
So, thank you. Thank you very much. The mixing process is a very different process than the recording process. The recording process is sort of like, you build a house. You know, you have all these parts, and you put them all together, and you have this house there. And the mixing process is more like then you start doing the decorating. It's kind of minutia work. And, you know, because the recording process was so fun and so kind of carefree and easy, and I recorded it out at Justin Vernon's house in Wisconsin, you know, I had such a great time, and I thought, like, this would be easy, like, going into mixing. And mixing was just as hard and emotionally exhausting and, like, confusing and scary as it ever is. And I work with John Congleton, who is, in my opinion, one of the best at this in the world. And in most people's opinion, he is continually producing some, you know, incredible record. And this is my third record working with him. I trust him, you know, to the ends of the earth. And even still, you know, you're working on a song and, you know, it just doesn't turn out the way that you thought it would. And it's scary. It's really scary. And what you have to do is, you know, trust that sometimes you can't. Sometimes you just got to follow what the song wants to do. There gets to be a point, and it's really happens in mixing the most, where the song eventually will start telling you what it wants to do, and you have to ignore that you had an intention of, you know, of what you hoped the song would be, what you thought in your mind the song would be, but it eventually gets to a point where that doesn't matter. That goes out the window. And so that song that you thought was going to be, you know, this really epic, huge, important thing on the record, sometimes it just sort of ends up being a kind of slow, grooving song. It ends up in the middle, and you try and fight it and try and fight it, but ultimately in the end, you have to sort of follow the song, and that's the sort of scariest leap of faith ever. And man, oh man, there was no exception. One of the reasons that when I'm mixing a record, I don't go out and talk to people is because I'm a miserable, nervous wreck for the entire week.
But isn't part of that... Well, you go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things about doing things for a while and really honing your craft is, and this is what I was kind of thinking, is you pick this, you know, a great person to collaborate with when you're mixing it. After you've done this for a little while, are you able to let go? And if he's saying, that the song needs to go this way, not that way, that maybe it's easier to trust kind of else's instinct. As you sort
this
of
is why,
have done it.
Why I work with him.
Because, but when you're like 23 and someone tells you, no, that's not the way, you're more like, no, this is what I want. And, you know, I feel like as creative, with time, you're able to sort of, maybe that guy knows what he's doing.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's why I work with him. Because even when I'll be like, I really think it should go this way. And John is great to work with because he and I have a really nice rapport where he can be like, look, man, this is how I feel. If you want, we can do that, but I think it will be a mistake. But a lot of times, too, like most of the time, he'll go, cool, let's explore that. And if I was right in the end, he's like, oh, man, I didn't see that coming, but that's great. That was a good move. But there are times when John goes to me, trust me, man, you don't want to do that. I'll go, okay. And man, oh man, it hurts a little bit. But in the end, like having this been my third record, like he's always right. He's always been right on the thing that he defends to the hilt. And that is why I work with someone like that. Like that's, you know, I started out making music sort of autonomously, like all alone in my bedroom.
Right.
And worked with, you know, my friend Radical Face for my early stuff and then started working with John, on my more recent stuff, and in the end, like, man, oh man, I will never be that autonomous musician again. I can't do it. By and large,
you know, isn't that kind of a sign of maturity too, though, when we kind of course, I'm real mature, but isn't it a sign of maturity the older we get, the more we realize, oh, wait, I don't know everything. It is a collaboration, and, you know, we're all just bozos on a bus, and we need to learn from one another. You know, I think it takes maturity to see that. We give up our rebel days.
I think getting over the pride factor, I think you're right. I think being a creative, I think there's a lot of times there's this romance of being this kind of maverick, creative person that just does it all.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and that's a thing that's especially romanticized in creative fields of being like a visionary that just can do everything. But in actuality, that's a really rare thing. And I think what's odd too is that there's not a lot of fields like, you know, like we don't romanticize like, There's no guy out there that's just designing and building every car for Christ. You know, like this is a thing that is kind of unique to the creative field. Like, whereas a lot of almost every other field, the romance of the team is heralded. You know, like the team of engineers that sent a man to the moon. You know, like You know,
I think it's a relaxing feeling to come to the realization is we need other people to make our life complete. Yeah. It's a relaxing feeling.
It really is, and it feels great to just, like, man, I want horns on this. Let's call Reggie. Mm-hmm. Reggie comes over, Reggie plays horns for about 8 hours straight, and then all the horns are on the record. And you just, I sit there and go, I just cheer. It's just amazing to watch this thing happen with other people. Whereas if I was trying to do this myself, A, I don't know how to play horns, and B, they bring insight to the thing that I would never expect. When I have someone come and play on a record, I'll generally like tell them what I want, and I'll have them do that. And then I'll give them notes, I'll have them do it again, and then for the third take, I'll just be like, all right, you do whatever you want. And a lot of times, the thing that they want to do after hearing what I want to do is better. Because they're able to see things in the music that I just don't see. And that's why I bring these people around.
Yeah, I think having those fresh perspectives, it always makes work better, you know, when you kind of get out of your own head. Do you have a group that you sort of always kind of start the process with? Like, I was thinking, we talked to Mike Eagle a while back, and I think I mentioned to you that he's a fan of yours as well. And
Mike is the homie.
He's such a good guy. And I was thinking, when I was talking to him, the stuff that's coming out of Hellfire Club right now is so good.
Yeah.
It is all so good. And I feel like they're all able to push each other, and what resulted at the end of the year were just incredible records from all of them. Do you have kind of a group that you, I don't know, you kind of run with, that you're able to sort of see what they're doing and that influences you and so on and so forth?
Not in the more like structured like hip hop sense as like Hellfire Club is, in that like they have this crew of people. But I generally sort of have like, I'm sort of a weird kind of like, I never had a rap crew in my life. I never did that route. I've always sort of been kind of free-floating, I suppose. So by and large, because of that, it affords me the opportunity to sort of cherry-pick from everybody else's crew. And so there are a lot of friends that, like, I do. I mean, the people that I interact with creatively for, you know, creative advice and structure to help the most are my friends POS and Sims from Doomtree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then on top of that, like, the guys that I play that, you know, back me up, Oscar, Mo, my band, I go to them a lot, Oscar especially. And then, you know, just sort of anytime I have, like, you know, when a record starts to take shape and I have the demos and songs, a lot of times what musicians end up doing when we're hanging out like together on a, you know, Friday night and it's, you know, 3 a.m. and we're, you know, drinking whiskey is like we start playing each other's demos and asking for feedback. And that's, I mean, we do that so much. And I do that with tons of different musicians. And I do that with friends that aren't musicians that are creative. Like, you know, it's 3 a.m, you're like, I got a song. Can I play it for you? Hear what you think, you know? And the answer is always yes, because we all do that for each other.
It's kind of like that TV show Nashville when they all get together and do that.
I bet it's exactly like that. I haven't seen that show.
Oh,
I didn't know that was a show, and I was out in Nashville, and I met some really nice Australian girl that apparently is on that show. I didn't know that was a thing, though.
Oh, really? Yeah, you had to be like, oh, right, yeah, I love that show, ma'am.
Well, they were like, yeah, I'm in the show Nashville. And it's not, I mean, this is clearly my fault, because that show is a wildly popular show. I go back to the hotel after having a drink with these nice people in Nashville and, like, look it up, and I'm like, oh, wow, that's, like, one of the biggest shows in America. I just don't really watch a lot of television. Mostly when I watch television is sports, and that's about it. So it's my...
Oh, listen, that show's great. It's second best to Real Housewives of New York.
you prefer New York over any of the other cities?
No, I tell you, the craziest one is Orange County. That's where they get in the best fights. But anyway, I watch Real Housewives and Hoda and Kathy Lee. I'm sure you don't watch that either.
No, I don't. They're on a little too early in the morning for me.
Because you've been up all night. You've been up all night.
8 a.m. is not a time that I often get up. It's a time that sometimes I go to bed.
The other thing you've been doing a lot of is releasing stuff from kind of the archives, the Astronautilus archives, as it were. And I think that's been really cool to see. And there's things that I've missed, like that Mike Wiebe freestyle you have.
Yeah.
It's like the greatest thing ever.
And yeah, Mike is.
I totally missed that back in the day when I put it out.
It's been really fun. I think part of it, too, is, again, sort of speaking about, like, one of the sort of side effects of, achieving some level of artistic maturity is learning to love your older work for what it is. Because some of my early stuff is painful to me to listen to sometimes. Like, and stuff that people love. Like, there is a core group of my fans that still think my first record is my best record, which absolutely boggles my mind. Like, it confuses me to no end because I just think, I just don't get it. It just sounds terrible. but I have a very different relationship to my work, naturally and understandably. But one of the things that, like, in the last 2 years, I've started to, like, become secure enough in who I am that I am okay with who I used to be.
Wow, that's cool.
Like, in the way that, like, you know, you get old enough that you're not embarrassed by your dorky middle school photos anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Because you're like, that person is so far away from where I am now. And, like, in reality, a lot of this, because I'm sort of working backwards in time on these releases, and to ultimately lead back to this big release of, like, my first three EPs that I made in Texas. Those are just so rough and so awkward. But the thing is that they're, like, almost 15 years old, and that person who made those is just not me anymore. I'm starting to enjoy the history of it. The history of it is starting to make me okay with the musical failings, I feel, or the musical awkwardness of it.
Yeah, I think that's nice. I mean, there's always... I put together my portfolio a little while back, and you don't have to love it all. I mean, there's some real shit work that I've done in my past, but there's a couple bright spots. And that's all you want to get out of it.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to connect the dots between that old stuff and, you know, like it was it's a realization that I sort of came to, like, I'm pretty oblivious sometimes of people's interest in me as, like, a piece of culture. And so the idea that, like, why would anybody want to hear this? Like, I would think, like, why would anybody want to hear this old junk, you know, was my thought for a long time. And then talking to people, like, people were like, but we actually do want to hear this old junk. And it started to make me think, like, I like hearing the old junk from all the artists that I love, and I'm pretty sure they hate that stuff just as much as I hate this stuff.
Yeah.
and, you know, like, and that's my own sort of, like, the TV show Nashville. It's not my, like, it's my fault that I don't know about it. It's not Nashville's fault. It's my fault that I think that this music is awkward and clumsy, but chances are everybody else that loves my stuff is going to want to hear it. Whether they think it's great or not, they still probably want to hear it just from a historical, archaeological sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a weird thing to accept.
Yeah, because I, like, your song, My Dinner with Andy, is, like, it's one of those songs that I can never get tired of, which must be completely awesome. Weird to you. But it's one that I can listen to anytime. Where so many other songs I just burn out, but this one, I don't know, I always come back to it.
That's great.
What a compliment.
It's a really, that's a high praise. And you know, sort of like in that sense, like, man, oh, man, I listened to that song maybe like a month ago and for the first time in forever. And just was like, it was hard for me to listen to, because I have such a different relationship with it. It's a weird process getting to understand that your relationship to your own work is so on a totally different planet than everybody else's relationship to your work.
But I think that's what's so different about what you do versus what I do. And it's really fascinating to me when artists don't... there was this whole thing... Do you remember the band Soul Coughing?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So it's band in the... Yeah, Mommy, I miss it. The band in the 90s.
Yeah.
They're real big. And they had this big falling out.
Is that like Maroon 5?
They were not like Maroon 5.
It's just basically the Maroon 5 of the 90s.
Yeah, let's just say for conversation's sake, the Maroon 5 of the 90s. But the lead singer, Mike Doty, had this big falling out with the band and just refused to play any of the songs because his relationship was so sour. And it took him like a lot of therapy and whatever to finally kind of realize, oh, people have a different relationship with these songs than I do. You know, for me, it's like I remember like my early college days, and it's all kind of like nice.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting to just like watch him kind of via social media, kind of have to have this like, oh, I hated that time in my life, but this person enjoyed theirs.
Yeah, it's sort of a funny thing that like, so like there's some of those old songs, people always want to hear those old songs when I play live. And, you know, some of them I have just, you know, songs like Ocean Walk or whatever, I've probably played Ocean Walk over 1,000 times a month. And at this point, from the amount of shows that I play and for how long that song's been, I've probably played it 1,000 times. And I sometimes just absolutely loathe playing it. And by and large, because, you know, I've just burnt out on it. But then I've had to come to this realization of, like, you know, I'm not playing these shows for me. Like, I'm here to make these people's day. Like, I'm here to entertain these people. And so there's a balancing act there because I don't want to play Ocean Walk so many times that I just hate playing it. And ultimately then am Tom York up there, you know, with Creep playing in the background and not even singing it and just holding the microphone out and letting everybody else sing it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to get to that point where I'm so jaded with the song, but I also want to play the song and make people happy. And so it's a sort of balancing act of, you know, taking time. And now it's getting easier now that I have more songs and a bigger catalog that I can kind of cycle through. But taking the time to, you know, put a song off on the back burner for a couple of tours and then bring it back out so that it's when I do play it again after not playing it for a year, like I think I took a year off of playing Ocean Walk. And then when I played it again, it was just like I had this great reawakening and reconnection with the song. And all of a sudden it thrilled me to play. And now, like, lately, after really, like, hating playing it for, like, 2 years and playing it anyway, then I took a year off, and then we started playing it again, and it's so much fun to play now. And that's been a really, like, strange and, like, joyful experience. It feels like reconnecting with an old friend, you know?
That's nice.
Yeah, it is. It's a really nice thing.
And you've been introducing some of the new stuff in your more recent sets, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And how's that going over? Because I remember when you first previewed Trouble Hunters at Good Records, and you're like, I made this song about the Revolutionary War, and I was like, I don't know if that's a good idea. And then you played, I was like, that's a really fucking good song. But I remember you're like, I wrote this, it's a historical Revolutionary War, I don't know. But it was absolutely fantastic. And I was just wondering how those new ones have kind of gone over in your sets.
There's a reason, like, so every record I make, there is a song on there, at least one song on there, but sometimes two, that when I make them, I am terrified of the song. Terrified. And, like, truly, like, losing sleep at night when I, like, listening to the song, thinking people are going to hate this. But, like, getting back to that idea of, like, you have to follow where the song takes you.
Yeah.
You follow where the song takes you, and all of a sudden, Trouble Hunters, which was originally going to be sort of like an electronic-y kind of dancey song, eventually just became this, like, Dinosaur Jr. rock song about the American Revolutionary War. And as it was unfolding, we're, like, working on in the studio, and we're adding these guitars, and I'm like, that's what has to go here, and that's going to end my career. And just, like, knowing that this is what the song is supposed to be and doing it, but, like, thinking in the back of your mind, like, boy, I have to eat this steak, but I know this steak is poison. And then so the point of, like, trying those things out on every record is to see, like, to see what people think. And so just recently, like, after I finished, 2 days after I finished mixing the record, I did a show in Dallas where I just did the same thing, where I just previewed a bunch of stuff. I played probably 2/3 of the new record, almost all of it playing it for the first time. And there's a song on the new record that is a huge departure from my old stuff. It is a straight-up rap song. It's the most rap song I've ever made in my life. And I'm still a little terrified of this song, but playing it live that night kind of settled those demons in the back of my mind. Like, I'm still scared as to what people are going to think when they hear it on a record.
Yeah.
But it's clearly, like, anybody who listens to the record, it's the standout track. A, because it's so different, and B, because I think it's a really good song. But because it's departure is so huge, I just keep thinking, once, like, every single record, the song that scares me the most always ends up being the most popular song. It was Trouble Hunters on that. It was Secrets on Our Lips on the one before. It was My Dinner with Andy on the one before that. Like, those are the songs that scare me the most, and those songs end up being the most popular.
But those are also the songs that are where you're pushing and you're doing something different. You know, it's nice to me, with anyone that's any creative fields, but especially music, there's times where, like, you hear a record and you're just like, they just felt like they needed to make a record. And there's people that make records and you hear that record and you're like, that needed to be made. Like the Newsleader Kenny. I was like, Newsleader Kenny record, do they really need it? And I heard it and I'm like, yes, that record needed to be made.
Cause that that's has good to hear. I heard the single off of it. I really liked it.
It's really fantastic.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's interesting, like, a while back, like, you know, for the longest time, like, growing up, I was the biggest Beck fan, you know, and yeah. It was just like, you know, like, for a lot of people, when a new Beck record came out, everyone just went and listened to it.
Yeah.
Like, we all got it. We all listened to it. That was just the deal, because it was always good and it was always exciting. And I felt for the longest time the same way about the Flaming Lips as well.
Yeah.
Where every time the Flaming Lips record would come out, I would listen to it. And I had been a fan of both of them since I was in eighth grade, you know, 20
yeah,
years.
Me too.
And there was a period, there was both of them, sort of around the same time, where, like, I forget which Beck record it was specifically. I think it was Güero, where it came out and it just felt like he remade Odelay.
I totally agree. It all became the same.
And then for the Flaming Lips, after Yoshimi, it just sort of felt like they were remaking Yoshimi sort of over and over again.
Yeah.
And unfairly, they may have, both of those artists may have transitioned back into making wildly creative and inventive music. But because I had come to a relationship with those artists that the expectation was change, when they gave me something that wasn't change, it tasted bad in my mouth.
Yeah.
And in the same sense that there are artists, too, that the expectation is the same. You always want more of the same. Like, I don't want Young Jeezy to make a psych rock record, you know? I want Young Jeezy to make Young Jeezy over and over and over again. I want him to talk about selling drugs. I want him to talk about cars. I want him to say, hey, on songs. I want that's what I want from Young Jeezy. And so the expectation with Jeezy is I always want Jeezy. And then for the longest time, the expectation with Beck and Flaming Lips was change. I want something new. I want something different. And so when they didn't, it didn't feel right. And if Cheesy came out with a psych record, he'd really have to stick the landing on that for me to be convinced by it. You know, like, and I personally am hoping to, or hoping that I have, or trying to establish that I am an artist that you hope for change in and expect change in, so that, you know, people that have been listening to me in the long haul can sort of ride with me when all of a sudden I take a huge left turn, you know, into something totally different.
Yeah, and I think it's also, it's almost with artists that you expect something from, that you expect a sound, it's almost like you just want them to kind of keep up with the times, as it were. It's like, I want to hear what you're doing, but with kind of, especially, I think with rap records, you know, like, like Lil Wayne sounds a little tired because Lil Wayne now sounds like Lil Wayne from 2001. And you're like, okay,
exactly.
Could you bring some kind of modern production to this? Because it's, like, I like it, but it's not doing anything for me.
Well, especially with rap music, because rap music is what's beautiful and exciting about rap music is that rap music evolves so fast.
Yes.
It evolves so much faster than every other genre of music, and it's the reason that, like, so many of my, like, rock friends and folk friends and punk friends, all eventually, the older they get more and more into rap and, like, and pop rap music. Like John Congleton listening to, like, pop rap music because they love the how fast it evolves. This is why Justin Vernon is the same way. Like, you know, like, I think his fans would be so confused to know that he is most of the time listening to, like, rap music and dance music. Like, I think that they think that he's just always listening to Townes Van Zandt crying, you know, like, and I think that, like, my fans probably think the same thing, that I'm just always listening to weirdo rap music, but in actuality, I'm mostly listening to Young Jeezy. Like, and what's interesting to me about that music, what's exciting about rap music is that it evolves so quickly. Like, literally, the sound that is 6 months ago, it's just totally different from what everyone's doing now. And it's like everyone's using autotune. No one's using autotune. Like it happens so fast, and it's, to me, that's such a thrilling thing. And there's a lot of that benefits from the ease with which that music is made. You're not like wrangling an orchestra, like, you know, it's just like churning out beats. But then also too, it's fashion music. Like it's fad music, and you know, a lot of the music. I was having this discussion actually with Buck 65 a couple of days ago about a lot of the rap music that I grew up on is so dated to me.
Very much.
But I can't listen to a lot of it.
I just re-listened to Fear of an All-Black Planet by Public Enemy the other day.
Yeah.
And it's like listening to a time capsule. It's great, but you are listening to a time capsule.
Yeah, and you know, what's interesting is that there are records from my youth that still stand up. That I still listen to it, and I just go, wow, it still excites me the way it excited me when I was 13. And then there are records from my youth that I put on, and the records that meant so much to me when I was young, and I cannot connect to them at all. And the most startling to me was Tribe Called Quest. I can't connect with any Tribe records anymore.
Really?
For some reason, which is a group that meant the world to me. Now, by contrast, in the same neighborhood, all the De La Soul records still connect for me.
Yeah.
Except for the first one. But that was sort of just a silly record to begin with. But, like, they all still connect and resonate with me. Whereas the Tribe records, I just kind of... All of a sudden, like, I started listening to it, and I realized, like, wow, you're just not really saying anything or a very good rapper. Like, it's sort of like the curtain was lifted for me. And it's not like I'm begrudging anybody else. I don't think they're terrible. It's just like I don't connect to it anymore, which is a really weird feeling, because it's like, man, I used to love eating apple pie, and now apple pie tastes gross. Like, like I used to love apple pie, and now apple pie just tastes gross. Like, I don't even get why I liked apple pie in the first place. Like, what's the love
kinda
of
like apples? Hey, Butler, it's kind of like those fish sticks.
Yeah, I tell this story a lot to people, It's things from your youth that you remember so well. Like, I was in college, and I came home, and Mom's like, "Hey, what do you want to eat?" And I was like, "Man, I love fish sticks. I used to love fish sticks. We made me some fish sticks." And so I think she kind of knew. She was like,
"Yeah,
okay, I'll make you some fish sticks." And she made me fish sticks. I get them. They're nice, golden brown. Put the ketchup on the plate. They were fucking horrible.
Yeah, totally. Because it's like fish elbows. Right? Yeah. That's a perfect example.
But it's also funny, like, do you have records that you know are still significant but you can't listen to? Like, for instance, Nirvana's Nevermind is, by any standard, a great record. The only time I've been able to listen to it and kind of enjoy it, I was in a bar with my sister in New Orleans, and they were just playing it loud as hell. And I was like, this is how this record should be heard. It's great. If I put it on in my headphones, I'm like, have like uncomfortable, like I feel like high school acne breaking out. It takes me to a weird place. Yeah. It's like I can't listen to it on my own.
I was 11. I think I was 11 when Kurt Cobain died. Like, I was the age for that.
Yeah.
I had long blonde hair. I had thumb holes in my sweaters. I wore a black armband the day that he committed suicide. Like, I was all in on that band in such a huge way. And I am actually super scared to go back and listen to those records. Because I don't want to have that fish stick thing happen. I don't want to not like Nirvana. Like, Tribe was kind of okay for me to let go of because I had De La Soul. Like, I felt okay with that because it was like, oh, cool, De La Soul's still there for me. And they're sort of analogous in my mind. If I lose Nirvana, I don't know. Like, I can't lose Nirvana. Like, I can't.
And it was affirming to me to hear it just played loud as hell in a bar. And to me, that kind of gave it back to me. And it sort of said, it's okay to just not listen to it on your own, but this record is great heard like this. And this is how it was made to be played.
Sort of inversely. So I grew up at the beach. I grew up in a beach community, and there are kind of tropes of beach life that are universal. So you go to any beach town anywhere in the world, and they're all sort of the same. Like, beach towns are sort of all just the same thing. And one of those sort of tropes is the music that you hear in beach towns. So, like, you could go to any beach town in the world, and stand is on a street corner, and it's only a matter of time before you hear Bob Marley. Like, that's just the way it is. Because of the era that I was living in, I was living in a beach town at the time when Sublime was just wildly hugely popular.
Yes.
Before the lead singer died. And I hated Sublime. I hated them so much. And it was just like, because it was just so, like, ubiquitous. It was just everywhere.
Yeah.
You couldn't escape Sublime. Because if you just stood there, some, you know, convertible yellow Mustang full of blonde girls would drive by blasting Sublime. And I hated it. And I just had this feeling in my mind always of just, this is just the band that I fuck, you know? And I remember years and years later, you know, I've graduated from college, I've moved back to Florida, I've moved to Seattle, I'm in Seattle, in a bar, I, you know, 10 years removed from living in Florida, and a Sublime song comes on, and it's just so kind of, literally the least beachy town in the world. I'm in Seattle, Washington. And it just comes on in this bar, and I hear it, and I'm like, man, a really good song. Like, a really good song. And I'm just sitting there, and I was drunk, it was my first drink at the bar, having a beer, and I hear this, and I'm like, that's a really good song, and it just turned my world upside down, because I hated fish sticks growing up, and all of a sudden I realized that fish sticks are great, and I've been missing out on the whole time.
Yeah, but to the beach thing, I thought it was really interesting on the Jason Feathers record, how much you channeled. I mean, granted, you're almost playing like a character on that record, but you really went back to that beachy kind of Florida roots.
Well, so that record, the thing that was the most fun about that record is that record was the ultimate exercise in letting the song take you where it's supposed to go. Like, there was no... Because we sort of approached that record with this, like, emphasis, like of fun, there was never, like, a... You just followed the song the whole time. And we had no preconceived notion about what the record was going to be. Like, we just, like, let's just keep going. And it sort of all started with, like, Ryan Olsen, who made a lot of the, you know, basics of the music for it, had some beats, and I just started freestyling over it. And we used the Randy effects on my voice, because we were like, that sounds awesome, let's do that. And then we're like, let's just do that for the whole record. Like, it was just always just following these things, and there was no, like, yeah, let's make this weird, psychedelic, gangster rap country beach southern record. There was no, like, preconceived notion. It was just sort of like, let's just follow it. And all of a sudden, that was the thing that emerged. And about, like, one-third of the way through the process, we were sort of laughing about, like, wow, it's weird that this theme is emerging of like, kind of southern and specifically Florida, like, southern right. kind of weird, like, the weird amount, like, so a lot of times people think of Florida, they think of Orlando or they think of Miami. But in actuality, Florida is southern. And most of Florida is redneck. And the epicenter of redneck Florida is Jacksonville. And so that record feels like a Florida record. And I remember, like, we were talking about it, and I was explaining to them about this place that's right on the border between Florida and Alabama, in the panhandle, on the ocean. Or the Gulf of Mexico, rather. And it's called, it's a bar called Floribama. And half the bar is in Florida and half the bar is in Alabama.
Of course it is.
It's Floribama. And this is around, like, Orange Beach, Alabama. And to put it, like, in sort of, like, historical context, like, of what the kind of vibe that you're going to have in this place, there's a bar back in the canals, the intercoastal waterways, that you can only get to by boat, and that bar is what Jimmy Buffett wrote Cheeseburger in Paradise about. Like,
wow.
this is the scene here. It's a beach town, but it's a weird kind of mixture of
it's the redneck Riviera beach. As they call it.
It is the redneck Riviera, 100%. And Floribama is an amazingly funny place because it's been knocked down by every hurricane that comes through there. And so it's rebuilt. It's a huge, like, huge compound. It's like three bars, two stages. They have this, like, mullet tossing competition, like mullet the fish, not mullet the hair. Mullet tossing competition.
Either would be good.
So, yeah, either would be fun. Either are entertaining. And, like, it's really funny because it's a patchwork building that's sort of, like, knocked down, rebuilt, taking the scraps, putting plywood together. But it became, like, the spiritual, like, kind of hub of the entire record, like this weird world where, like, southern, you know, kind of redneck mania and beach life all sort of collide, and the sort of seedy underbelly that can kind of crawl out of it. And it was such a fun thing to channel that part of my youth, and honestly, a part of my youth that when I was living there, you know, I couldn't actively avoid it,
right.
You know. And I couldn't actively avoid, even though I was a surfer, like, I hated surf music, you know? And even though I was a southerner, I hated the redneck, Lynyrd Skynyrd music of my town.
Yeah.
And now, like, man, I ride so hard for Lynyrd Skynyrd. I love that band so much. Like, and I now am very proud of all of that, you know? And so it was really fun to make a record that actually channeled that, and that's what that ended up being, sort of, kind of, by hook or by crook.
So for the new record, what's the next step? You've started previewing it. What's that timeline between now, where you've got, like, the cake is baked, and now you kind of, like...
Well, essentially, I'm putting the cake is baked, the frosting is on the cake, and now I'm putting it on the windowsill, letting it cool and waiting for someone to come by it. So this is a sort of unique process for me because normally, so the way, most often, the way getting a record deal works after you've got your, you know, most people make their first record or, you know, kind of make demos of the first record in their bedroom. And, you know, they either put it out and someone comes along and gives them money. And then that sort of starts your career process. And then after that, the way that it generally works is you sort of trade on your previous work to get a record deal.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, traditionally, like, for the last few records, it's always been like, this is what I made last time. This is what I intend to make next time. Give me money to make it. And
yeah.
They give you money, you sign a contract, they own part of that record, blah, 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 goes on from there. And I got really exhausted of that process, especially because I tried to make my records so different from album to album that, like, a lot of times I would go to a record label and I'd be like, this is what I made. This is what I am about to make. Give me money for it. And, A, what I think I'm going to make never turns out exactly like that. It might be close, but it's never exactly like that because
sure.
You got to follow the way the album leads you. And, B, almost always the record labels are confused by what they got by me, from me. Because I think even though I told them it's not going to be anything like you, what you heard before, they get it and they go, ah, it isn't. It really isn't. And so I think that confuses them. Though my last record label, Big Four, was the most positive experience in that realm where they were just, because they're mostly musician run, they knew that they didn't know what they were going to get, and they were very flexible on that.
Yeah, you talked about them very favorably, I remember.
Yeah, they're great. I mean, like, honestly, they're a fantastic label, but they have inherent limitations in that they are just a couple of people, you know? They don't
yeah.
And so there's only so much that they can do, but what they do is fantastic, and they give home to a lot of music that would not have a home, including, like, Bus Driver's stuff came out with them, and a bunch of really great artists. You know, they support artists in a really beautiful way, and they were the only positive experience I've had with the record label. But this time, I wanted to make the record first, so that I could then go around and be like, this is what you're getting. Do you like it? Great. You don't like it? That's fine, too. See you later. Like, and so this has been a really interesting process. I've never had a record to shop around, which is the term of art. And so we're just starting that process now. The record's mixed, and so now we are, you know, sending it off to people at record labels or friends who are friends with someone at a record label. And, you know, this is when you start calling in every favor that anyone ever owes you. and you, like, start running through your phone book and going, oh, wait, that person probably knows someone at a record label. I'll send them the label, send them the record. And you sort of just kind of, you know, start working every angle you have. And it's a totally new thing for me. And right now it's actually really fun. Because I know that the record will come out. Like, I'm in a fortunate enough position. I'm not in, like, the dire straits of a new artist who's, like, looking for a label because he has no connection.
Right.
Like, no matter what, there's labels that will put it out. Like, that's not a concern. But now we're playing, like, we're shooting for the moon now. Okay, cool. So we know no matter what it's going to happen. But, like, hey, let's see if we can get these guys to put it out or those guys to put it out. Like, labels that would never give us the time of day normally we're at least bending their ear now. Who knows what will come of it? Yeah, it's a fun experience so far. I'm sure that, you know, as it gets more serious and, you know, the clock starts winding down and contracts start coming out, and it'll become less fun. But right now it's just fun because it's all just, you know, why not? Like, why not send it to those people? Like, the worst that's going to happen is it's not going to come out with them, and that's fine. So right now it's just...
What a great place to be, Andy. That's a great place to be.
It is, and it's a really... The last 2 years of my career have been really interesting, by and large, too, because I have changed the way that I've approached my career. I'm now everything's a little bit more stable, but I'm able to relax a little bit. I'm able to focus on things other than my career. I'm able to focus on my physical and mental health I'm able to sort of kind of take a foot off the gas every once in a while, you know, which is a great feeling. But the other thing on top of it all is, like, when I first started out, you know, doing this 20 years ago, when I first started out rapping 20 years ago, and I would, you know, you'd be a teenager and you'd daydream about where it could go. Even, like, in my wildest daydreams as a teenager, the most insane, far out, this will never happen in my life dream about my relationship as a rapper, like, those dreams, I passed those years ago. Like, years ago. And it was a realization that I had when I was in Russia, like, playing for 5,000 people in Russia, that it was like, I couldn't have even imagined this. I was incapable of imagining where my career is.
That's awesome.
And that,
Andy, you've made it.
Well, that's a longer conversation. I think there's no making it. Because the thing, too, is, like, you know, now my dreams have changed. You know, my dreams have evolved and they've changed. Because I have, by all means, like, I have achieved. I think that there's no making it. I think that there is achieving a goal and then setting a new goal.
Yes.
Achieving a goal and setting a new goal.
Yeah.
Because, like, honestly, like, to be perfectly frank, like, while I make a living off of music, like, I'm not making enough money to raise a family or, you know, set to retire on when I'm 60. You know, like,
yeah,
I'm
but you're not living with your parents.
No, I'm not living with my parents anymore. And no matter what, like, that's, you know, I'm not saying that to be the ungrateful. I think that that's, like, unnecessary. I think it's a necessary thing in a creative field to always have a little bit of, like, dissatisfaction mm-hmm. with your current status.
Yeah, because really, it motivates really you.
Yeah, and you, in the same sense, you have to, you can't be totally dissatisfied because then you're a miserable person. And you, honestly, no one should be miserable doing what I do for a living. Like, that's unacceptable because that's a really fun job. Like, it's a really fun job. It doesn't mean it's not stressful, but I'm not allowed to be miserable. And so, like, you know, you have to have some time where you can rest on your laurels and be satisfied with what you did. But I think that there's a certain level of dissatisfaction that's important as a business, as a small business owner, which I am, but also as an artist, to always want to grow the business and always want to grow the art. And mm-hmm. your next step as a business and your next step as an artist should always be your best thing yet.
Well, you want to stay hungry, and it's those artists that that just, they're not really hungry, they're just kind of going through the motions like we talked about before. It's, I think that's when art gets stale, you know?
If this becomes easy or boring, or, I mean, everybody gets into this business because they don't want to work a real job, you know?
Right.
And we all get into this because we just want to have fun. And if it ever gets to a point where it's not fun anymore, if it ever gets to a point where it's easy, then it's time to get another job. Like, it's time to do something different. Because it should always be fun, and it should always be challenging, and it should always be rewarding. And if it ceases to be that, then it's time for a career change.
Well, I thought it was interesting, too. I was reading an interview with Run the Jewels, and both those guys mm-hmm. were kind of at this, I don't think my career is going anywhere anymore. And then they got together.
For sure.
And they made that, kind of out of that,
yep.
we got nothing to lose. And what comes out of it, but just an absolutely fantastic album. And I think it's that kind of drive.
Yeah, for sure. And I think by and large, like, I mean, sometimes you got to kind of upset the apple cart, you know? And I think both of those dudes whose both of their works I have admired since the beginning.
Yeah, me too.
But both of them also... Like, I love the early Killer Mike stuff. The first Company Flow record was a life-changing record for me.
Yeah,
like, truly
absolutely.
Life-changing. For me as an artist, like, just blew the doors right off the hinges. But then ultimately, both of them, I checked out on their work eventually because I felt like their work started to become uninspired. And then so amazing, like, when they got together, holy cow, how exciting it was. And what... For me, just as someone that's, you know, I don't know those dudes personally, but to see the joy that they have in making music again, Like, it seemed like their old stuff was sort of, like you said, like, you're talking about the Fleet or Kitty record, the idea of, like, they were just making a record because that's what they were supposed right. to do, because they hadn't made a record in 2 years. Whereas, like, these records feel like they're making a record because, God, they love making these records. Like,
yeah.
Like, and that's great. Like, that's such an exciting, and even, like, it makes you root for people like that. You root for people that have joy in their work. You know, whether they're, you know, making donuts or making rap music. Oh, man, for sure. And I talked to Killer Mike for a bit, and, like, he's not, like, my boy or anything, but we've talked before. The joy in that man is infectious. And the joy that you see when they perform just spreads through the entire crowd, which is really interesting because the music that they make is often pretty dark.
Yes, it's real dark.
Pretty dark and pretty pessimistic about the world at large. But the experience, even through that art that is dark and pessimistic and cynical, there is a joy there that is stronger and bigger than the music itself. That is really
that amazing. Sounds like the 60s, Andy. That sounds like the music we listened to in the 60s.
I think that's totally apropos because right now, like, it's almost everybody is making political music,
mm-hmm.
whether they yeah. like it or not. And even the fun music is political, like, and critical of things and dark at times, but still fun. Yeah, still
yeah.
fun. And I think that's a really, really good yeah. like analog. It is like the 60s.
It really is. It takes me back to Woodstock.
Mom, you weren't at
Did
Woodstock.
Did you go to Woodstock?
No, she didn't go to Woodstock.
No, of course not. I was born and raised in Mississippi. We'd never heard of it.
It's a long road from Mississippi to Woodstock.
Thank you so much to Astronautilus for being on our show. We are so proud of that man and everything that he's accomplished. Be sure to follow him online at astronautilus.com. That's astronautilis.com for tour dates, for links to his albums, and be sure to follow him on social media. He's really active, he responds to his fans quite a bit, and like we covered in the podcast, he's releasing a lot of old material right now, so it's kind of an exciting time to follow him. Be sure to check out the Jason Feathers record, buy all of his merch, and you will not be disappointed. Like us, but our calling is what shapes us now. Won't be held back, won't be tied up, won't be pinned down. Won't be held back, won't be tied up, won't be pinned down. Won't be held back, won't be tied up, won't be pinned down. Won't be held back, won't be tied up, won't be pinned down. Won't be held back, won't be. Not now. Dreamed up the mask, give me the charcoal and the paper now. From a simple deck of cards, laid ace to kings. A finger nail slipped in the king's Charlemagne. I flip the edge and trace the grain and watch it fall like a breaking wave. The ace of spades, last splat. Drop the suicide kings, they all turn bicycle backs. Stared at the pattern, pair of seraphim flash, and it just fit elegant. Oh shit, that's strange. You can waste away pain with one thing. Watch make a break, sweat can't tame. It's dumb spring, and one day it's as plain as the nose above your smug grin. Like, look what the cat dragged in. Woke from a dream, hands heavy and cold sweat. Jump from the bed, snatch the charcoal quick. Sketching frantically upon the bedroom brick. Came together.